America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Days, 12 hours, 48 minutes, 56 seconds. Until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, barring impeachment. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. George W. Bush, in 2000 and 2004, went from 35% of the Hispanic vote to 40% of the Hispanic vote. The reason why was principally because of evangelical Protestant Hispanics, where he went from 44% support to 56% support from 2000 to 2004. This is a group, evangelical Protestants in general, that the Republican Party has been courting for some time in a really aggressive way. And frankly, they're taking a bit of a hit with the Hispanic group with the current immigration legislation, which is a whole nother story. But in a way, it's micro to the macro. It's the small to the large, the small example of the larger issue. And it appears to me that one of the things, part of this program, this campaign that's being done with folks like David Barton, who just makes up quotes from the founders and that America was founded as a Christian nation, et cetera, and then puts them out, and occasionally they even show up in textbooks, is to reinvent the history of the United States. Stephen Mansfield is with us. He's the author of New York Times bestselling author of The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of the American Soldier, Benedict the 16th, His Life and Mission, Never Give In, The Extraordinary Character of Winston Churchill, and his new book, Ten Tortured Words, How the Founding Fathers Tried to Protect Religion in America and What's Happened Since. Stephen Mansfield, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with me. I have read your book, and I am mystified by a few things. First of all, you have in your appendix, you say Thomas Jefferson's five books on religion, the Virginia Statutes. I've written a book on Jefferson, the history of Jefferson. I spent 4 years researching it. I have the complete 20-volume set of the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson. And I spent all day yesterday looking through everything I could find. The Virginia Bill of Religious Freedom, Jefferson authored. In fact, he was so proud of it, he has it on his tombstone. But the other four pieces of legislation that you attribute to Jefferson that you have in your book, as far as I can tell, Patrick Henry was probably the author of one of them, and I can't find specific authors for any of the others, but clearly Jefferson never claimed authorship of any of them. Why are they in your book?
Well, they were issued over Jefferson's signature with his authority from his committee, and they are attributed to him historically, and so the reason I have them in the book is to simply say, though he authored what sounds like a statute that is in favor of dismantling any influence of religion whatsoever in government, public policy, what have you, the fact is he was in favor of other areas of support for religion's impact on public policy.
We're talking about a bill for the saving of the property the church heretofore by law established, a bill for punishing disturbers of religious worship and Sabbath breakers, a bill for appointing days of public fasting and thanksgiving, a bill annulling marriages prohibited by the Levitical law and appointing the mode of solemnizing lawful marriage. What you say is among the best known of Thomas Jefferson's writings is the Virginia Act for Establishing Religious Freedom. True. Written in 1779, the act was written as part of the body of law for the new state of Virginia. What you didn't note is that Patrick Henry prevented it from being enacted into law for 2 years. He had a ferocious battle with Thomas Jefferson over this for 2 years because Patrick Henry did not want the religious freedom in Virginia. But you go on to say, less well known is that this act was but one of five, was but one bill among five that Jefferson wrote pertaining to religion. And I would submit to you, sir, that that's not factual. Jefferson did not write those other four bills. He had nothing to do with them. They may have come out of a committee he had some part of. They may have come out of a government that he was part of. But I guarantee you he would have disavowed them had he had an opportunity.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think we just disagree to the same extent that not every word in the Declaration of Independence was Jefferson's, but we attribute authorship to him. The same is true of these bills. But I think the broader issue is that Thomas Jefferson is not the, you know, rabid secularist that we often portray. I mean, this is a man who began attending church in the House of Representatives 2 days after he penned the famous Danbury Baptist letter, that gave us the language separation of church and state. This is a man who...
Again, I'm finding that in David Barton's work, but I'm not finding that in Jefferson's work. In fact, Jefferson, talking about George Washington in his personal diary, February 1st, 1799, he said, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never on any occasion said a word in the public which showed that he had a belief in the Christian religion. And they thought they should so pen their address as to force him at length to declare publicly whether or not he was a Christian. However, and I'm quoting Jefferson from his diary. You can look it up, February 1, 1799. However, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address particularly except that which he passed over without notice. And then he goes on to say that, let's see, where to go, Washington never did say a word on the subject of Christianity in any of his public papers, except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states where he resigns his commission in the army, when he speaks of the benign influence of the Christian religion. I know that Governor Morris, who pretended to be in his secrets, in Washington's confidence, believed himself to be so, has often told me that General Washington believed no more of the Christian system than he himself, Mr. Morris, did. Morris was an atheist.
Well, and we can certainly trot out other quotes about Washington if he's the issue that speak of him in prayer. We have, of course, the famous prayer book in which he affirms belief in Jesus. I mean, I'm not a debate regarding
which he did
Washington.
Not author.
We can have it another time, but I think the bigger issue.
Well, okay, let's go to Jefferson then.
Was Mr. Jefferson a consistent secularist?
And in Notes on Virginia, Jefferson says the legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others. But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. One of his most famous sayings.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, we all agree that he wrote that, and most of us would celebrate that. I think the bigger issue is what did he actually do, and what's the implication for the understanding of the Establishment Clause? And his understanding of the Establishment Clause was that it prevented the federal government from establishing a state church, but it did not in any way prevent the states from being as religious as they want to be, or individuals. And that's more to the point of the Everson versus Board of Education.
But he was strongly opposed to that. I mean, that was Massachusetts nearly seceded during Jefferson's presidency over their wanting to go back to being puritanical and religious. Patrick Henry wanted Virginia to be, as I recall, it was Congregationalist. It might have been Presbyterian. And Jefferson strongly opposed those things. I mean, he wrote about it at length, particularly in his correspondence with John Adams. How can you just overlook all this stuff in your book?
Well, I don't. I'm making a very specific case that doesn't involve the entire history of colonial and early America from a religious perspective. I think the more important issue is, did Thomas Jefferson suggest language and hold a view that called for an utterly secular marketplace of ideas? Did he call for the absolute separation of any kind of religion from any kind of government?
And I would say yes, he did.
And the answer is no. I mean, then you have to answer. Why did he actually sign off on sending Catholic missionaries to India? Why did he print copies of Bibles? Why did he encourage the reading of the Bible at the
University? Well, he didn't do any of those things. The government did at the time that he was president. You know, the famous quote from the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., "I've sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility over every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man." You're familiar with this. It's in your book. You don't provide the context. Have you read the entire letter?
Oh, of course I have. Of course I have. And I think the issue that I mean, it's interesting. The quote you've just cited affirms the fact that Jefferson believed in a God. And that's
right.
That's
so,
where we begin
so,
with a fresh understanding of Jefferson.
Perfect, perfect. So let me then, it's only three paragraphs. This is Ben Rush. This was 2 months before his election as president. He opens the letter by asking Ben Rush not to make it public because it could be so inflammatory. And dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vetum, which is Latin for the angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, here he's talking about the First Amendment, your 10 words, the delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States and in various states. And as every sect believes its own form, the true one, everyone perhaps hopes for its own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country, and he's talking about his own election in 2 months, the returning good sense sense of our country. Pause that. Pause the music there, would you please, Chris? The returning good sense of our music threatens abortion to their hopes, and they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, and enough too, in their opinion. I mean, what he's saying is he's gonna take on the preachers.
Absolutely. And by the way, had most of the preachers that I know been living at that time, they would have fought the same fight he was fighting against religious establishment, against the state church, against even at the state level, an institutionalization of one denomination over another. That's not the fight we're fighting today, but that was the fight he was fighting then. And most
I would submit to you that that is the fight that we're fighting today.
George
Bush giving over $1 billion to faith-based initiatives last year. I mean, that's the absolute opposite of anything that Jefferson or Madison would have ever supported.
Well, you're right about Jefferson and Madison at certain periods in their life. However, faith-based initiatives does not establish a national church, nor does it prefer one religion or another. It just encourages religion generally, which is exactly what Jefferson and Madison did during their terms in office.
But you know what Madison's first veto was as president. The first thing he vetoed was a law that gave money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. And in his veto message, he said this is wrong because it's going to establish the precedent of giving money to religious organizations for charity. Charity is the appropriate purpose of a secular government. He wrote that in his veto message.
Exactly, exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. And I recognize that Jefferson and Madison, at various times in their lives, were opposed to the kind of thing I'm advocating in the book. However, they are two of 126 founding fathers. Why do we spend all of our time discussing their ideas and the various phases of their thinking?
Well, I am with you because about 80% of your book is about Jefferson.
All different views.
Yeah, well, I am with you because about 80% of your book is about Jefferson, at least what I was able to read of it.
Because I had to address separation of church and state. That's not the total picture. And as you well know, what I was dealing with was the Everson case, which is directly relevant to Jefferson above all other founding fathers.
Yeah. Well, we have to wrap it up. Stephen Mansfield, I appreciate your coming on with me and being willing to have a rough and tumble conversation.
Happy to do it. Happy to do it. Have a good day.
Thank you. The book is 10 Tortured Words, How the Founding Fathers Tried to Protect Religion in America and What's Happened Since. The author, Stephen Mansfield, New York Times bestselling author. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Wipe your hands, shake it off, and you dance.
23 minutes past the hour. Hey, by the way, head over to airamerica.com. Join the Tom Hartman blog on the Tom Hartman page. You have to click on my name to get to the page. And start blogging. That could put you in the running for our daily giveaway. At the end of today, my producer, David Poole, here, is going to pick what, in his opinion, in his totally arbitrary opinion, is the best comment of the day from our Air America blog. It could be a serious comment, a quick funny one, whatever, and that person will receive a free autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So blog with us at airamerica.com for your chance to get a free book. The House and Senate Judiciary Committees have both issued subpoenas. I want to get into that in just a second. I do want to just wrap up and frame our conversation from the previous segment, because I think that this is so key to the Republican strategies for 2008, and has been, frankly, for the last 15 years or so since David Barton and others started reinventing the history of the United States, that speaking as a Christian and speaking as a person who considers himself spiritual, I'm not sure religious is the right word, but in any case, I am concerned. I share, frankly, I think probably more of James Madison's than Thomas Jefferson's concerns. Jefferson being a deist, Madison being, as I recall, an Episcopalian. Madison was concerned that if government started giving money to churches, it would contaminate religion. And I think that the examples of, for example, Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing being up at the top of the FEMA page is the place where you should give money after Hurricane Katrina. And I don't recall thousands of Operation Blessing homes being built in New Orleans. Haven't seen it. I mean, it's just, you know, these kind of things, you know, Pat Robertson, a billionaire, a billion-dollar empire built on religion, concerns me. As a Christian, it concerns me. It concerns me when I hear religion being used as a political tool. In fact, I would submit to you that anybody who suggests that religion should be used as a political tool, who calls themselves a Christian, isn't. Because, you know, one of Jesus's probably most important statements was, render unto Caesar what is Caesar and unto God's what is God's. In other words, he was the original person to call for a separation of church and state. And so it just, you know, really concerns me when I come across this kind of stuff. Jefferson also pointing out in 1814, a letter to Thomas Cooper, he says, finally, in answer to the question of why the Ten Commandments should not now be a part of the common law of England or the common law of the United States, we may say that they are not because they never were. Anyone who asserts the Ten Commandments are the basis of American or British law is manifestly believing a document that is a manifest forgery. And Jefferson goes on to say, Christianity was not introduced to England until the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place around the year 589 and that of the last at 686. Hence, there was a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity no part of it. He said, we might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. This is Thomas Jefferson, you know, who, so it's just the attempts to reinvent the founders and use religion as a political tool, in my opinion, are not only dangerous to democracy, they're also dangerous to religion. And I'm very concerned about it. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Not gonna be fooled again.
We don't get fooled again.
Ain't gonna happen. Ain't gonna happen. We're waking up here, 35 minutes past the hour. And in fact, here is your opportunity to say thank you to some of the Democrats in Congress. The toll-free number, or not the toll-free number, the telephone number for Congress, 202-225-3121. And these are the kind of moments when catching somebody right, you know, congratulations. It's so much better to catch people doing things right than doing wrong. When you catch people doing things wrong over time, they just start feeling, oh no, I'm besieged. You know, they're getting all these angry calls from their constituents and a siege mentality sets in. It's so important that when members of Congress do things right, that we catch them doing something right. And so I'd like to say to Congressman John Conyers, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and Senator Pat Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, congratulations. Indeed, we caught you doing something right. I mean, these guys, this is great. And all the members of the committee, if your member of Congress is a member of one of these committees, or not, for that matter, I would call first your member of Congress and then also call Conyers and Leahy. But in particular, call your member of Congress and say, please support John Conyers and Pat Leahy, because these guys have issued subpoenas for Harriet Myers and Sarah Taylor. Sarah Taylor is the White House political director. And of course, Harriet Myers she worked for Karl Rove, and Harriet Myers was George Bush's lawyer. And these are the first subpoenas coming out of the White House delivered to the White House regarding the firings, this scandal around the attorneys, and requiring the Senate committee for Taylor requires her to testify on July 11th, and the House one for Myers is for July 12th. I mean, this is coming up soon, and the White House has already essentially said they're not going to testify. We're going to claim executive privilege. And this is going to come to a showdown. It's going to come to a showdown in Congress, and we're going to need every single member of Congress we can get, Democratic and Republican, because this is about the fundamental issues of governance. This is not about, you know, gotcha, right, wrong, all that kind of thing. This is about the fundamental issues of governance. So I strongly encourage you to call 202-225-3121. And I've got a couple of toll-free numbers here. You just never know which ones are working and which ones aren't. The last one I have is 866-220-0044. 866-220-0044. You could try that and get through it. Just say, hey, thank you. We are so pleased that if you're talking to a member of the House, that the House Judiciary Committee, if you're talking to one of your two senators, that the Senate Judiciary Committee has issued these subpoenas, and I want you, my member of Congress, for example, if I was calling Darlene Hooley, who is my representative in the United States House of Representatives, I would say to their office, and I will today, please support John Conyers in absolutely enforcing these subpoenas and use the power of Congress to support these subpoenas. John Conyers said, quote, "Let me be clear. This subpoena is not a request. It is a demand on behalf of the American people for the White House to make available the documents and individuals we are requesting to help us answer the questions that remain. The breadcrumbs in this investigation have always led to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue." And Pat Leahy says, "The White House cannot have it both ways. It cannot stonewall congressional investigations by refusing to provide documents and witnesses while claiming nothing improper occurred. Some at the White House may hope to thwart our constitutional oversight efforts by locking the doors and closing the curtains, but we will keep asking until we get to the truth. And they are only going to be able to do that if you support them." So give your member of Congress a call and give him a shout and say, hey, you know, this is a big deal. Mark in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to K-Talk. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'm concerned about this separation of church and state issue because the way I always look at it, a person's belief or religion, if you will, is a private matter that's between him and his beliefs or him and his maker. And by introducing it into a public institution such as government, it destroys whatever privacy we've got.
At that level, yeah, absolutely.
At that level. And not only that, the slippery slope that Madison was probably talking about was the kind of favoritism that is granted those in lobbying positions, whether it's for a church or for a Halliburton, to become, no bid church of the country.
Well, really, contractors. I mean, look at Operation Blessing and Hurricane Katrina. You had the official website of FEMA, the official U.S. government website up there, and George Bush said, you know, the entire force of the federal government, people all over America were, what should we do? What should we do? We want to help. We want to help. And the answer was, go to the FEMA website. And on the FEMA website, there were two places that you could send money, the American Red Cross and Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing. And hundreds of millions of dollars were collected as a consequence of being on those government websites that are paid for with your dollars and mine. And I've not seen any accounting for how that money was used by Pat Robertson. Have you?
No, and that whole issue of FEMA and all those do-gooding organizations being co-opted by certain parties is just one way to... Well, even this United Nations and G8 thing, it's just a way to tell everybody that they're doing good and when in fact they're picking their pocket.
Yeah, it's pushing the oligarchy even further. Mark, thanks for the call. Well said. John in Glendora, California. Hey, John.
Good morning, Tom. Your first, the guy you had on the first part of the hour.
Yeah, Stephen Mansfield.
What really blows me away on this is every time you counter these people with facts, when you said, something about Jefferson and he said, well, we'll just have to disagree. He's not really disagreeing with you. He's disagreeing with Jefferson. And I really hate it when they rewrite history like this. And when generations down the line go back and read what they've done, they're going to really think that this is what happened. And
In fact, some of David Barton's made-up quotes that are attributed to the founders. I mean, he literally made up quotes and attributed them to the founders. Some of them have actually shown up in textbooks.
It just blows me away. And like Reagan, they've rewritten history to make him look like he was some kind of deity or something when he was really a nightmare.
Oh, this
was
realized. Yeah, I mean, you know, a couple of days ago was the anniversary of his tear down this wall speech, and I was watching the commentary on, I think it was CNN, and they were all, the consensus among all the talking heads was, oh, he was such a popular president. Everybody loved him so much. You know, they don't love George Bush so much, but everybody loved him. I'm sorry, Reagan was not a popular president. He had moments of popularity, but he had a lot of moments of unpopularity. He wasn't popular in the United States. He wasn't popular around the world. He was made fun of as a cowboy. He was, you know, over 150 times saying, I don't recall, and Iran-Contra. There were a lot of concerns about Reagan and what he was doing, and as I said, they have reinvented Reagan, and they're going to reinvent Bush. This is why they've got $500 million allocated for the Bush Presidential Library for scholars, for visiting scholars, to rewrite the history of the Bush administration. Dick in London, Ontario. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think I speak for everybody that work you did in Croatia was the best stuff that I think you've ever done. That panel was just awesome.
It was a great conversation.
And yesterday, the way you sum things up, it was just awesome because obviously you had a lot of time to talk to people and think about it on your trip. And, you got the best job in the world as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. I'm having a great time.
Having a great time. Now, to take on what you said yesterday, what I've thought for a long time that there has to be a roadmap here. And you look at the PNAC and their pronouncement.
You mean a roadmap on the part of the Bush-Cheney bunch and all the neocons behind them.
And the thing is, you'll never find it unless you could get into their private emails. But if you think about it, and the Grover Norquist and people like that, if you look at it, they have gone after every single possible place in the administration, in the United States government, that could be pushed. Either, if you go down the list, it's just not, it can't possibly be an accident of all the places they've nudged, all the places they've gone right to the edge of legality, all the places that they've put people in place who would defend their position. There's absolutely no way there isn't a roadmap for this.
Well, there is a roadmap. I mean, Fred Malik, this is what I was talking about yesterday. Fred Malik wrote it in 1971.
Yeah.
Karl Rove has been playing it out. He's referred to the 100 years of Republican rule,
exactly.
Of single-party rule. Single-party rule is what the Soviet Union was. We've seen this movie before, and this is what they're trying to bring us.
And the thing is, if you think about it, that what's really galling and really frightening is the fact that they talk about democracy, democracy, democracy. These guys don't believe.
Actually, they don't. They use the word freedom instead.
And they
because
don't
they don't. They don't like the word democracy.
See, I'm a computer consultant, and I happen to be in the kind of area where I occasionally hang out with captains of industry. You know, I'm taken out for dinner, or I go golfing and stuff like that, or wannabe captains of industry. And today, when I call you, I happen to be home. But these guys, when I talk to them, they don't have any concept of the greater good. All they care about is proving how smart they are, right?
Yeah, well, it goes back. I mean, Reagan established this thing of greed is good, and it's a meme that has been very, very destructive to the United States and all around the world. Dick, thanks so much for the call. Well, point well made. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
We live in the land of plenty, but many things aren't plenty anymore. Like the water from our sink, they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the ozone. Look what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the sea, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees. So let's leave some blue.
Good plan. Better plan. Keep it and pass it on now. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, airamerica.com, tomhartman.com, our websites, you blogging over at airamerica.com, our message boards and whatnot over at tomhartman.com, and articles. Lewis in L.A. Hey, Lewis, what's up?
Well, Tom, you said to call D.C. I called my congressman from my district, Adam Schiff. I also called Conyers' office and let him know that we support the articles being drawn up. And the guy asked me, was there a newscast or something? Because we're getting inundated with phone calls. So keep it up. It's working.
That's great. Yeah, well, that's, as far as we can tell, I mean, best guess, there's 2.5 to 3 million people listening to the show. And if a small fraction of them are making those phone calls, then that's just a good and positive thing, I think. And it's so important that we thank and congratulate these guys when they do well, because then they'll do more of it.
Well, Tom, along those lines, I want to thank you for doing well. And one thing I got to give you credit for, you're always real courteous with your callers, even when you're tight on time. And I know that that's got to be tough on you. So know you're appreciated.
Well, thank you, Lewis. I appreciate it. And thanks for the call. Very kind of you. Charlie in New Rochelle, New Jersey. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? As far as all the issues of the religious right, you know, abortion and homosexuality, why can't we just diffuse the whole thing by saying that we just can't support a law based on religious fiat any more than we could support a law that would ban vehicular traffic and commerce between Friday sundown and Saturday sundown, or a law that
the Constitution essentially
during Ramadan?
Yeah, the Constitution kind of pushes in that direction. The First Amendment says that, you know, we can't have an official religion, and
right.
Then there's also a place in the Constitution where it says that you can't use a religious test to measure whether somebody's fit for office, and, you know, at the federal level. But the problem is that there's this kind of broad merging of religion and morality, and we do want to have and legislate morality. We want to say, for example, it's illegal to steal things. It's illegal to bribe members of Congress. Some folks would say, okay, stealing is one of the Ten Commandments. That's religion. Are you legislating religion?
Right. I see what you mean. But
as long as we
join them and argue the individual points, we continue this mythology that they're the only players in the game. Or that they have the corner on morality.
Yeah, well, and that's the point. That's what we need to be doing. And Charlie, thank you for the call. We need to reclaim morality in the United States and say, you know, the real morality is the liberal morality. If you want to put it in the Christian context or any other religious context, I mean, you could quote Maimonides or you know, others, if, for that matter. I mean, David and Solomon. I mean, you know, in Judaism, in Christianity, Jesus. I mean, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. You know, right on down the board. The essence of, quote, religious morality has always been help the poor. I mean, that's the bottom line. In all ways, you know, heal the sick, clothe the homeless, clothe the naked, house the homeless, you know, and like that. I mean, that has always been at the core of morality, and that's liberal / progressive morality, and that's also the true morality of religion. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. How's everything? Quick question for your guest. I was wondering, was he aware of Thomas Jefferson's own version of the Bible, where he omitted? Eliminated the Book of Revelations and all the miracles?
You know, I was going to bring that up with him, and I just, you know, we just ran out of time. In fact, as it was, we did something that we almost never do here, which is crash the break, and we don't like to do it because it's tough on some of our radio stations. But I don't know. I just don't know. But you're absolutely right, James, and I think it's fascinating. Thomas Jefferson took the New Testament, and he, with a razor blade, cut out all of, you know, metaphorically, cut out all of the miracles that Jesus did. And so it basically reinvented Jesus as a philosopher, the Prince of Peace, a philosopher of peace and morality. And that book, the Jefferson Bible, has been in print ever since it first went into print, and I think it was 1823 or thereabouts. It was about 10 years after he left the presidency that it first went into print. And it's still in print. You can go to any of the online bookstores. You can walk into your local bookstore and buy it right now. So, you know, it's out there and it's around. So, anyhow, Larry in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Larry.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I just like to know why you guys just seem to want to take Jesus out of everything.
I don't want to take Jesus out of anything other than government.
Well, but he belongs everywhere, you know. He has a role to play in everything we do. He's our creator. Yeah, the way you look
So in your opinion, our government, you think that we should use the force of government, which ultimately is the force of guys with guns, to tell people who are Jewish that they must become Christian?
No, just, you know, it says he gave us the government, so we have to obey the government because he gave it to us by him, by Jesus, the Lord.
Where does it say that?
I can't quote it, but I know it's in there.
Well, I would encourage you to go back and read the New Testament, Larry. I've done it four times myself, actually the entire Bible. And what you will find is that a fellow came, as I recall, as a centurion, came to Jesus and handed him a coin, and it was a picture of Caesar on it, and he said, "What should I do?" And he was asking actually a question about tithing, you know, how should I tithe? And Jesus said, you know, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's. In other words, you know, let's keep these things separate. That was the original statement of Christianity, is to separate government from religion, not to integrate it. In fact, that's Jesus died at the hands of a government. It was the Romans who crucified him. And they crucified him because he was saying, hey, you know, we're not going to go along with your government. And so anyway, 57 minutes past the hour. Well, I appreciate the call, though. It's always nice to hear from people who want to disagree with me. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. It's amazing. The folks with the North American Treaty, the North American Treaty Organization, NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, are starting to get it. And this is like a really important thing. I mean, this is really important news. And frankly, I didn't even see it covered in any of the American media. In addition to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Oregonian, the local paper here, and we get USA Today, I also subscribe to the Financial Times out of the UK, which is also published here in the United States and is delivered daily. And that's where I found the story. And here it is. I mean, the headline, NATO acts on Afghan death rate. Now, keep in mind, and this is, again, one of those things that I think most Americans don't realize, we're no longer fighting a war in Afghanistan. We're no longer even maintaining an occupation in Afghanistan, we being the United States of America. We have successfully turned it over to NATO. NATO is now in charge of Afghanistan. And NATO has figured out something that the Bushies have not figured out with regard to Iraq or anything else, frankly, in the world. And that is that if you just go after people with a gun in their face, it's not going to be the most successful way to bring people to win their hearts and minds, shall we say. To bring peace to a nation, to make things work. The consequence of the conservative belief that the only purpose of government is to punish or to maintain a military to defend or to, go offensive in a defensive way, you know, to take out threats. The consequence of that conservative belief that government should play no role in the lives of average citizens, the government should not be a backstop. It shouldn't be there for when times are tough. It shouldn't be there to help people achieve their potential. The consequence of that is being played out every single day in Iraq. Because when Paul Bremer went in there and rewrote the Constitution, the Iraqi Constitution, illegally, by the way, essentially what he said to the people of Iraq is, we're going to let the free market take care of you now. We're going to do away with free health care. We're going to do away with Social Security. We're going to do away with food subsidies. We're going to do away, you know, and on it goes. We're going to shut down the state industries. And they did. the state-run industries. And we're just going to expect that the free market is going to solve all problems, because that's our ideology. That's what we believe. And just like every other time it's been tried in the 7,000-year history of humanity, of what we call civilization, obviously the history of humanity goes back far longer than that, but Western civilization, every time it's been tried, it failed. It led to an oligarchy. It led to a small number of people seizing an enormous amount of power, a large number of people becoming very poor. And as those people start fighting over the scraps, war. So here's the flip side of that. In Afghanistan, NATO has said, we're going to do something different. This is from today's Financial Times. As I said, the headline reads, NATO acts on Afghan death rate. NATO defense ministers are shifting the alliance's stance on Afghanistan, placing greater emphasis on the battle for hearts and minds. At talks in Brussels that begin tomorrow, the ministers are scheduled to discuss ways to reduce civilian casualties and to provide greater humanitarian aid. Previous such gatherings were dominated by U.S. demands for reinforcements. That would be military reinforcements. They go on to note, European diplomats in Kabul said civilian casualties might have increased because of intelligence blunders by small U.S. forces teams working with their Afghan counterparts. And then they quote Sarah Holowinski, executive director of the U.S.-based Campaign for Innocent Civilians in Conflict. She said, if NATO wants to claim the higher moral ground, it has to show it's serious. For example, only 5 out of 26 NATO countries have donated to the compensation fund created last year to help war victims. What does that say to the Afghan people? She's right. And so Des Brown, the defense secretary of the United Kingdom, says, and I quote, we need to understand that preventing civilian casualties is crucially important in sustaining the support of the population. So to the extent that there may be some hope for Afghanistan, I mean, as long as we try to do what Russia tried to do in Afghanistan, which is subdue the population by force, this is a country that has not been subdued by force in several thousand years. It's not going to start tomorrow. The extent to which we continue trying to do that in Afghanistan is the extent to which we're going to fail. And NATO is figuring this out and saying, okay, let's abandon the American way and let's do it let me rephrase that. Let's abandon the Bush administration way and do it the way that Truman did when he helped us rebuild Europe. Let's help put this country back together rather than continue taking it apart. Which brings us, in my mind, to our, you know, a good time to take a look at what's going on with the situation in Iraq.
In the shadows of, I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security updates and developments in Iraq as of 10:15 GMT today, Wednesday, from Reuters. Dateline Samarra, an explosion hit a revered Shiite shrine in the city of Samarra. This is the one where the Golden Mosque, the dome, was blown up last year. Now the two remaining minarets have been blown up. A curfew has been imposed in both Samarra and Baghdad as a consequence. In Ramadi, 4 Iraqi policemen were killed and 11 officers wounded by a suicide car bomber targeting their checkpoint outside Ramadi. In Baghdad, a U.S. Marine was killed in combat operations in Anbar province. In Mandili, a bomb targeting the police chief of the town killed 3 of his bodyguards and wounded 5 other people. In Bakuba, a person was killed and 6 wounded by a mortar attack. In Baghdad, the bodies of 26 people were found in different parts of Baghdad overnight. All had been shot. In Kirkuk, the bridge southwest of Kirkuk connecting that city with Tikrit was blown up overnight. In Khan Bani Saad, one person was killed and 8 wounded when a truck laden with chlorine exploded near an Iraqi army base. In Baghdad, gunmen kidnapped Faliha Wadi Mitch Thob, the managing editor of the state-run Al Sahab Daily newspaper. In Baghdad, two people were killed and six wounded by a roadside bomb on Tuesday. And in Baghdad, gunmen killed three policemen and set their vehicle on fire near Baghdad. You know, this so illustrates the absolute collapse of conservative thought, of conservative policies. On this here, and my point, and or a point to make, is that it's nothing new. On this day in history, 1381. In 1380, you'll recall, in the 1340s, the Black Death, the bubonic plague, swept Europe. And between a third and in some places as few as a quarter, and other places as many as a half, broadly about a third of the population of Europe was killed by this disease over about a 20-year period. As a consequence of this, the cost of labor went up. On this day in history in 1381, now this is the next generation, these are the children of the people who survived the bubonic plague, revolted. A guy by the name of Wat Tyler marched into London on this day in history in 1381 and began burning and looting the city. Why? The scarcity of labor brought on by the Black Death led to higher wages. Parliament, however, resisted these changes to the traditional feudal system and passed laws to hold down wages. They passed maximum wage laws. In 1380, peasant discontent reached a breaking point. The peasants' revolt began in Kent, a county in southeast England. The rebels chose Wat Tyler as their leader, and he led his growing army through London, capturing the towns of Maidstone, Rochester, and Canterbury along the way. After he was denied a meeting with King Richard II, he led the rebels into London on June 13, 1381, burning and plundering the city. He led a peasant force against the Tower of London, capturing that fortress and executing the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, the rebellion was put down. Hundreds were executed. Wat Tyler, his head was chopped off and displayed on a pole in a field in London. It wasn't the end of feudalism in England, but it was the beginning of the rising up of the middle class. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Minutes past the hour. Hey, head over to airamerica.com. Join the Tom Hartman blog on the Tom Hartman page. It actually says Louise Hartman's blog because she starts it every day. And start blogging. That can put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of today. Our producer, David Poole, is going to, in a totally capricious and arbitrary fashion, actually using his best judgment, but you never know about David's best judgment. He's going to pick the best comment of the day from our Air America blog. It could be a serious comment or just a quick, funny one. The person that David picks is going to receive a free autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So blog with us over at airamerica.com for your chance to win. And, of course, in the news for the day, from the wire services, as they say, in an attempt to break the nagging logjam over immigration, congressional leaders announced today that they were hiring illegal immigrants to write the nation's new immigration bill. While some observers criticized the decision to employ illegals to draft the very bill that would regulate themselves, Senator John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, said the move was a win-win for the American people. No one understands the thorny issue of immigration better than the people who have been sneaking into our country, Mr. Kyle said. Plus, these folks work cheap. One outspoken critic of the plan was CNN's Lou Dobbs, who blasted Congress for putting illegal immigrants in charge of the nation's immigration laws. That would be the equivalent of CNN outsourcing my xenophobic rants to Bangalore, Mr. Dobbs said. Gee, I wonder if that's going to happen. in a pretty, I could just see it now. Anyway, according to the plan, which went into effect at midnight, the U.S. will bus illegal aliens across the border to work as guest congressmen to draft the nation's new immigration laws. The illegals will remain in the country long enough to write the new immigration laws, after which they will be permitted to run for election for permanent congressman status. Juan Carmelo Gutierrez, 35, a former migrant worker who's taking advantage of the guest congressman program, says that while drafting the nation's immigration laws is arduous work, he still prefers it to his previous job. Being a congressman is definitely easier than picking fruit, said Mr. Gutierrez. Plus, you get most of the year off. Thanks to Andy Borowitz from the BorowitzReport.com, or BorowitzReport.com, for a little bit of levity. Also, Pittsburgh. Apparently, the people in Pittsburgh are not unlike the folks on the nude beach in Dubrovnik, which was right next to our hotel. I don't think I mentioned that on the air, did I? Greensboro, Pennsylvania, giving sultry looks and sexy smiles. This is a serious story, and a real story. Sexy smiles to the camera. 12 Pittsburgh-area women recently posed at Monongahela historical sites. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. Bearing it all, or almost all, to create a charity-driven calendar. The catch? The nearly nude ladies are all in their 70s and 80s, driven to adventure by a desire to raise money for the historical society in Monongahela, a small community 17 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. Overcoming fears a priest would walk by during a photo shoot or embarrassing their children and grandchildren, the women, all well-known members of the tight-knit community, are now eagerly awaiting the calendar's debut next month. Yeah, this is great. This is just sweet. That's just one of those sweet stories. Back to this notion that conservative thought is destroying America, I would suggest to you that it's not just, you know, our warlike policies that are destroying America. We are supporting in Pakistan a guy, Musharraf, who overthrew a democratically elected government. This is exactly the reason why Jefferson said every person in the country, every able-bodied man, you know, I think maybe we should extend that, but in any case, every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 to 47 should be a member of a local militia, so that you will not have a military elite that will overthrow a country. Well, it happened in Pakistan, and Musharraf is that guy, and, you know, had people killed. I mean, this is a guy who's had a whole bunch of people killed and is basically the dictator of the country. And again, this from today's Financial Times. Leaders of Pakistan's opposition last night urged the U.S. to push for the restoration of democracy in Pakistan, warning that Washington risked an intensification of anti-American sentiment if it continued to back the military rule of President Pervez Musharraf. They're saying this because Richard Boucher, is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, is showing up in Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. I guess actually arrived last night. He's meeting today with them. Although this week's searing heat, they note, at times topping 122 degrees Fahrenheit in Lahore, has kept the crowds off the streets, the government remains shaken by the scale of recent protests against General Musharraf's March 9th suspension of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They urged Mr. Boucher to call, this the U.S. representative, to call on General Musharraf to abandon his plan to have himself reelected president by the existing parliament. The shift in priorities has left the Bush administration open to charges of hypocrisy as it backs the Muslim world's most powerful military strongman. And by the way, I would add the guy who apparently is harboring Osama bin Laden in support of its goal of establishing democracies throughout the Islamic world. You get it? I mean, the opposition parties in Pakistan are pointing out the hypocrisy. Okay. Bush administration, you guys say that you are supporting democracy and that democracy should be spread to all the Muslim countries. And the largest, most powerful of them, the only one with a nuclear bomb, is being run by a dictator, a strongman, who wrote apparently a nice autobiography. But come on, the guy's a dictator and a killer. And you're going to support him to run for president again? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Strange days indeed.
We live in strange times. The old Chinese curse about interesting times. Actually, I think it's kind of cool listening, living in interesting times. Welcome back to Listener Supported Radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our program by supporting our sponsors like SacredGroundsCoffee.com and SmallDog.com and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One, 1-866-380-MEOW. And even more important, or particularly important, the sponsors that you hear on the local station that you're listening to. Let them know that you're listening. Let them know that you support. They're supporting us, because that's how this this thing called radio works. And we much appreciate it. Alonzo in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Alonzo, what's on your mind today? Alonzo?
Hi. How you doing?
Hey, you're on the air.
Okay. Well, I was calling about a cousin of mine who I'm real close with. Called me, and he converted to Islam, and he's calling me and emailed me a Media Matters article about Pat Robertson saying Islam is not a religion.
Yeah.
But he can even fix his mouth to even say whose religion is a religion in politics at all. It just it astounds me how he can sit and tell somebody that their religion is whatever.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree, and that's one of the big concerns that I have. And we started the first hour with the rewriting of the history of America and trying to rewrite America as if it was founded by a bunch of Christian zealots. There were some. Patrick Henry, for example, very much was what today would be called an evangelical. But the document itself that governs this country, the Constitution, does not mention God. It is a secular document, and it was intentionally done that way. This is a nation of laws, not a nation of religion. It's a nation that tolerates religion, in fact, encourages religion at a certain level, but not institutionally, not through government. Morgan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Morgan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a longtime listener, and I've read your book, but I was a history major at the University of Oregon, and the rewriting of history is very interesting to me. I'm reading a book right now called Fallen Founder. It's about Aaron Burr. Who's one of our founding fathers and a great patriot, and he was what would be today considered a slander campaign politically was thrown against him. But the writer of the book did something interesting, and I want to take the book eventually and cross out every time she renamed the Democrats, which were Jefferson's party. She renamed them Republicans. Yes, they were Democrat Republicans. Flash, with a slash in between.
It was actually the Democratic Republicans.
She renamed them Republicans throughout the book. And I want to cross out every time she does that and put Democrat back in there and ship it to her. She's at the University of Tulsa.
You want to get even more crazy about this, Morgan? Go over to whitehouse.gov. You know, just the official White House website, whitehouse.gov, and click on the little link over at the side on the left side that says Presidents, and then click on and it'll give you a list. And there's one that says History. Click on History, and it'll give you a list. You can sort it alphabetically or chronologically. Choose to sort it chronologically and look at whitehouse.gov's listing of the political affiliations of the presidents. They will tell you that Jefferson was a Republican, that Madison was a Republican, that Monroe was a Republican, that the first Democrat was Jackson, as I recall, was the first one that they identified.
Okay, well,
it's absolutely bizarre.
Didn't even get formed until after the Whigs collapsed. And what?
That's right. The Republican Party was formed on June 1st, 1856, in Jackson, Michigan. 1856. And Jefferson was president from 1800 to 1808, and yet they've got him listed as a Republican president. That's on the official White House website.
I think that's ridiculous, and I'm going to eventually write back to Miss Eisenhoff. I believe her name is Nancy Eisenhoff, and just write her an email and say, "Listen, you're rewriting history in the wrong way, and it's revisionist crap."
Yeah.
I
can't speak to that book, but the whole idea of revisionist crap, there's a lot of it going around, Morgan, and well said. Thank you very much. Lucian in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lucian.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I have to disagree with your espoused views on the air with regards to Iraq.
What did I espouse?
Well, at least from what I was listening to, I mean, you seem to give the impression that the administration's discussion about what their intentions are in Iraq are to be taken literally.
Oh, you, in other words, you think that I'm being that I'm one of those naive suckers who believes that when Bush says he wants to bring democracy to Iraq, he actually wants to bring democracy to Iraq.
Well, I'm just listening to what you're saying on the air.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting from it. And
yeah, okay.
I cannot
point
find
taken.
One example of either the provisional authority or the U.S. military's presence in Iraq as having even one effect to reduce the violence there.
Yeah. Well,
nothing they've done reduces the violence. They let
no, and in fact, we are the irritant. I mean, we are the thing that is one of the things that is producing the violence. I would submit to you that the main thing that is producing the violence there is economic. It's the destruction of the Iraqi economy. And that
well, exactly.
And that's the consequence. Go ahead.
But they're not stupid people.
No.
They know what they want, and they're getting it. You know,
yeah,
we
well,
should just start looking at what the outcome is of their actions and say that's what they want because they're getting it.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you, Lucian, and your point is well taken. Thank you. Robert in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Robert.
Hey, I really enjoy your show.
Thank
I'm
you.
Calling because I believe the war with Iran is imminent. And let me throw a couple of recent facts. Listen to the Republican debate. Romney, Giuliani, McCain, and Lieberman are all calling for bombing Iran. And Romney wants to use atomic bombs.
Yeah,
and,
did you see where Wes Clark, I mean, this is a guy who's actually seen combat, came out today and said to Joe Lieberman specifically, took him to task and said, you know, if this guy had ever served in the military, he wouldn't be talking like this and he needs to ramp down his rhetoric.
You know, I'm watching CNN right now. Two more mosques were attacked. This is a religious war. It's not an economic war. We don't have any high-level diplomats there. And the mainstream media, including Wolf Blitzer, doesn't ask the follow-up question. Says, what happened after we bombed Baghdad? Did that end the war?
Yeah, well, let me just...
All these Republicans, you guys want war. You want to bomb Iran. What do you think they're going to do? Just lie back and take it? Or are they going to attack Saudi oil fields with
sure.
refineries?
Which will drive up the profits of ExxonMobil and may well be again part of the plan. Who knows? But you said this is a religious war, not an economic war. Let me point out to you that in Saudi Arabia there is a large Shiite population. In fact, the majority of the people who live in the oil fields are Shiites. It's not the majority of the country is Sunni. In the Shia country of Iran, there's a sizable Sunni minority. In Lebanon, you have Shia, Druze, Sunnis and Christians and Jews. You have actually there's a lot of a fairly substantial Jewish community in Iran as well, and in Iraq. I would submit to you that this looks like a religious war, but that if everybody felt that their economic security, that their the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, if safety and security, if their ability to raise their family and have a decent life, if that was all under control, that the violence wouldn't be emerging. And it's emerging in a religious way because that's where the clear and obvious division is, the distinction is, but it's emerging as a consequence of economics.
Well, listen, I hope you just keep up the good work because I'm really disappointed in the way the mainstream media is covering these debates. They're not asking the follow-up questions. And these are really important questions. What happens after you bomb Iran? What's next?
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yep. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Robert. And in fact, we had we've had a number of people on this program. Scott Ritter back in December was predicting that in January or February there'd be a war. Cy Hirsch was on this program predicting that we were going to attack Iran. I think, frankly, that the election of Democrats to the House and Senate stopped it. I hope it didn't just postpone it. I think it stopped it. But, you know, we'll find out. We'll find out. David in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to comment on the subpoenas that were handed out. I think I'm really pleased with the Democratic Party on this issue.
Yeah, me too.
I'm very pleased that they handed out the subpoenas to Harriet Myers and the other lady. And I think that it's imperative that we do some oversight on this administration because they've had 6 years of no oversight. And no one investigating them on all their misdoings. And I think the Democrats are really playing dominoes here where they're trying to get one domino to crack and the rest of the dominoes will fall after that.
Yeah, there, and it will probably be something that we don't expect or we don't realize. But I agree with you. I think that there is going to be one of those threads that they pull on. I mean, nobody knew that third-rate burglary was going to bring down the Nixon administration. It's going to be something, but there is so much there. Something's going to come. Something's going to give. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you. We have about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, basically, a lot of folks call in, and sometimes you'll disagree with them on kind of a principled position, which is that Bush and Cheney kind of believe in their corporatist hype. And I think the one thing folks have to understand is that a lot of politicians don't believe that stuff, but because they have to get reelected, they have to play into the hands of the military-industrial complex, you know, the imperialists, the
APAC, right, and the credit card companies and the bankruptcy bill and things like that. So your suggestion is public financing, right?
Absolutely. Public financing of elections, and people can join groups that work on that all over the country. And here in Washington State, there's a group called Washington Public Campaigns. Their website is washclean.org, and they have an event this Friday. We'd love for folks to come out.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jeff, and good luck. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I hear the drums of war, they are changing. And everybody's getting in the groove. Laughing and dancing and talking and chatting and singing. We got nothing but love.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Just got an email from somebody saying, hey, maybe you're wrong about that White House website. I'm looking at it right now. It's, you know, whether all these guys were Republican, the White House website has been completely redone since the last time I looked at it. And here it is. Republican electors attempting to name both the president and vice president for their own party cast a tie vote between Jefferson and Aaron Burr. The House of Representatives, blah, 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 blah. Jefferson gradually assumed leadership of the Republicans. This is, although they do, actually, they do say the Democratic Republicans began to form. This is on the White House website. It didn't used to say that. That's interesting. So, I stand semi-corrected. But for the last 5 years, that's not what the White House website said. Trust me. You could check it out. Roberta in San Diego, California. Hey, Roberta, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Well,
hopefully.
Here's what's on my mind. I don't think the people in this country know that the Social Security Administration has turned hostile and adversarial toward the American people. Seniors, disabled people, veterans, seniors who are 62, millions of letters being sent out to people telling them that their benefits are stopping. You know, our most vulnerable people are being intimidated and deceived into believing that they have to do early retirement. And, of course, by retiring early, they don't have to pay you as much. You know, they send 3 pages of extremely confusing legal terms, which are orchestrated by attorneys behind the scenes, telling people that they owe $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 to Social Security in overpayments. And no one can understand what the letters are saying. And the people are down there, you know, begging and pleading for some help, people in wheelchairs and on breathing machines, and people who can barely stand up and barely walk or speak. I've been down there. I've seen this. You know, they're like down there begging for their little $300 or $500 benefits.
Mm. Yeah, I have a friend who, Michael Hutchison, in fact, there's a link off my homepage, tomhartman.com, to Michael's really quite amazing story that I encourage people to read, and who broke his neck and is paralyzed from the neck down and is living on Social Security. I could tell you some horror stories.
Well, I have a letter here in my hand that they sent me telling me that I owed them $15,000 in overpayments, which goes all the way back like 5 or 6 years ago. And, of course, you know, you get to appeal all this stuff, but it's completely insane and very stressful, and you can't figure out any of the letters because they're created by attorneys behind the scenes. And, of course, behind the scenes of all of this, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Alberto Gonzalez, and friends, those are the people that are orchestrating this.
Exactly. If you don't believe in government, you can't govern. If you don't believe the government should have a protective or a backstop function, then you start taking it apart. And that's what these guys are doing. They're taking apart the Labor Department. They're taking apart the Social Security Department. They want to privatize Social Security. Romney has come out and said, I believe, this is a headline I saw on one of the websites a couple of days ago, that Mitt Romney is saying he wants to privatize Social Security. I mean, let's turn it all over to Goldman Sachs. Won't that be a great idea? You think you're having problems right now with Social Security. Wait until you're dealing with something that resembles a credit card company. Roberta, thank you for the call and for raising the issue. It's interesting. I've gotten several emails from people recently who are turning into their 60s and talking about the letter. And I'm not that old, so I haven't gotten it. And I'm hoping somebody will forward one to me, because apparently there's something up with Social Security right now that probably needs to be exposed. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia.
Hey, Tom. I hear that John Salvador Option Negroponte is in Iraq. And then I hear about
Death Squad John.
Yes. And the mosque explosion. I haven't forgotten that these people have a plan to divide Iraq. I haven't forgotten that they really don't support Maliki. Alawi is who they want in power. So now he's over there pressuring Maliki, so I have to ask, is more violence an offer that Maliki can't refuse?
I think it may be. And in fact, yeah. If you look at today's New York Times, there's an article by Damian Cave. The headline is Iraqis Are Failing to Meet U.S. Benchmarks. And
oh,
you dig all the way down to the fifth page of this, if you print the thing out, it's 5 pages long, at the very end of the article. And let me just share just this little piece with this. The law was stymied by Ahmed Chalabi, who headed Iraq's debathification commission. Mr. Chalabi, the former Pentagon protege, relies on the commission for an official role in Iraq's government. Having just renovated a spacious office in the Green Zone, he has strongly opposed any effort to weaken his position or the country's policy on former Baathists. Mr. Chalabi and members of his organization sabotaged the American-backed plan by rallying opposition among Shiite government officials in southern Iraq, then taking their complaints to Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, Iraq's most powerful Shiite cleric. And the question in my mind is, is Chalabi sabotaging our plans, or is Chalabi part of our plans? Are we seeing, the neocons versus the realists? Are we seeing, right now there's this tension between the State Department and the Defense Department. To what extent is our own government fracturing internally with regard to Iraq policy?
Good questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
okay.
And your point about, and thanks for the call, Cynthia, your point about Negroponte, when Negroponte first went to Iraq as I recall, he was our ambassador to Iraq, or whatever it was, in the very early days. Negroponte went over to Iraq, and they kind of, brought him out of retirement and dusted him off. Of course, now he's head of the whole shooting match of the Homeland Security and whatnot. But when they first sent him over there, I said on this program, this was a couple, 3 years, two and a half years ago, thereabouts, something like that, I said, we sent this guy down to El Salvador, and within a few months, people were showing up dead with their hands bound behind their backs and bullets through their heads, which is why he has this name, Death Squad John. And it spread all across El Salvador and lasted for years. And I wonder how long it's going to be before that starts happening in Iraq. And it was just a matter of about a month and a half before it started happening in Iraq. Not that that necessarily means that Negroponte was making it happen or anything like that, but who knows? Who knows? What's going on in China? Is it really possible that a government could harvest organs from political prisoners and sell them on the black market? Right after the news. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
So Brian D. Kelly is just driving down the street. Well, actually, he's sitting in a pickup truck that's driving down the street. A friend of his is driving, and he's over in the passenger side, and he's got a video camera in his lap. Welcome back to the program, by the way. And a police officer pulls him over in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And apparently the bumper of the truck, there was something wrong with it or whatever. Anyhow, Kelly says he's stopped for traffic violation. And the guy's, he's 18 years, this is an 18-year-old kid. And he's into making movies. You know, every kid wants to have the next YouTube thing, right? Everybody, you know, it's like video is cool and the computers all do it now. And he's into making movies. So he, when the cop comes up to the car, the police officer comes up to the car, he picks up his video camera and says, I think I'll videotape this thing. He is now facing 7 years in the state prison. The police officer was sufficiently offended that he called for backup. Other police cars showed up and dragged this kid off. Here's the story from the Patriot News, article by Matt Miller. PennsylvaniaLive.com is where you can find it. Brian D. Kelly didn't think he was doing anything illegal when he used his video camera to record a Carlisle police officer during a traffic stop. Making movies was one of his hobbies, he said, and the stop was just another interesting event to film. Now he's worried about going to prison or being burdened with a criminal record. Kelly, 18, of Carlisle, was arrested on a felony wiretapping charge with a penalty of up to 7 years in state prison. His camera and film were seized by police during the May 24th stop, he said, and he spent 26 years in Cumberland County Prison until his mother posted her house as security for his bail. According to police, Kelly was riding in a pickup truck that had been stopped for alleged traffic violations. Police said the officer saw Kelly had a camera in his lap, aimed at him, and was concealing it with his hands. They said Kelly was arrested after he obeyed an order to turn the camera off and hand it over. Kelly said his friend was cited for speeding, and because his truck's bumper was too low, he said he held the camera in plain view and turned it on when the officer yelled at his pal. After about 20 minutes, the officer cited the driver on the traffic charges and told the men they were being recorded by a camera in his cruiser, Kelly said. He said, young man, turn off your blank camera, Kelly said. I turned it off and handed it to him. Six or seven more cops pulled up and they arrested me. Police also took film from his pockets that was not related to the traffic stop, he said. And, you know, it just goes on to this whole thing. You know, it's one of the things... On this last week, was it last week? Boy, time flies. Last week I was in Europe, and it was 23 and a half hours of not flying continuously, but, you know, changing planes here and there and all that kind of stuff. A long trip. And so I took an old Nero Wolfe novel with me. I love reading old books. You know, this is a story that was written by Rex Stout about a private detective, Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin, back in the one that I took with me. I think it was called The League of Frightened Men, and it was written in the 1940s. Just after World War II, probably 46, 47. And Lieutenant Kramer, right, the chief of homicide for New York Police Department, shows up at Nero Wolfe's front door and bangs on the door and demands to come in. And Archie opens the door with a crack with the chain on and says, sorry, you can't come in. You got no warrant. And Kramer's like, I want to talk to you. You can't come in. You got no warrant. And Kramer has to turn around and walk away. It actually used to be that way, by and large. And increasingly, as a result of these kind of COPS programs and whatnot, what we're seeing is the hyper-militarization of America and of our American police. And many of us are concerned about this. The rewriting of American history. I mean, this all fits in with the rewriting of American history all the way back. In fact, by the way, I'm back on the WhiteHouse.gov website here. They make it quite hard now to find the biographies of the various presidents, but I'm reading Jefferson's biography and telling about his political affiliation. It says, in Congress, Jefferson helped frame the Bill of Rights and enact the first revenue legislation. Out of his leadership in opposition to Hamilton's financial proposals, which he felt would unduly bestow wealth and power upon northern financiers, came the development of the Republican or Jeffersonian Party. Period. End of quote. Excuse me. This is from James Madison's biography. Fourth paragraph. He was a Republican. Yeah. When the Republican Party did not come into existence until 1856. It's just bizarre. So anyhow, I wanted to mention there's a couple of things here that I want to just kind of scattering around here in this third hour that I wanted to talk about. The first is this ongoing hypermilitarization of America, which concerns me. Another is, and as we look at the militarization of Iraq, and as I said in the last hour, in my opinion, the religious war, we have now several Sunni mosques have now been blown up in the last few hours in apparent retaliation for the big Shia mosque, the two minarets remaining, the mosque with the big golden dome, the dome already blown up once, in apparent retaliation for that. So it's like this sectarian civil war meltdown happening in Iraq. But as I pointed out, I don't believe that that would be happening if people had jobs. If there was a good, strong, vibrant economy. If in the 4 years that we occupied Iraq, we had rebuilt it the way that we rebuilt Germany and Japan in the first 4 years that we occupied those countries. And I don't have personal experience of that, but I certainly have heard the stories. My father was for 2 years in Japan with the occupation forces, arrived right after World War II. He joined the army as soon as he turned 17, when just before World War II was over, and so thus ended up with the occupation forces. And I'm concerned about the economy here in the United States as well. U.S. bond yields, this from today's Wall Street Journal, U.S. bond yields hit a five-year high. Now, you say that, a lot of people are going, what? What does a bond yield have to do with anything? Well, the bonds are the debt that we sell. So when George Bush says he's going to have a war in Iraq and he's not going to raise taxes to pay for it, he has to borrow the money. He's borrowing the money in your name and mine and the name of our children and grandchildren. And the way that he borrows that money is by issuing IOUs. These IOUs are called treasury notes. And the problem is that last week, in the middle of the week, now this is somewhat eased up today. I mean, just in the last 2 hours, I've been checking the financial news here, and just in the last couple of hours, it's eased up a little bit. But what happened last week was that They made an offering, and as my recollection is, it was $8 billion. I don't have that story right in front of me right now. This was in yesterday's paper. But they made an offering, or maybe it was $80 million, whatever it was. They made an offering of treasuries, and people didn't buy them initially. And so they had to start jacking up the amount of interest that they would pay until it reached a point where people said, yeah, we'll buy them. Now, in a way, this is taking the bond market back to normal, that long-term interest rates are getting to be higher than short-term interest rates. There's been this inversion for a while, and everybody's been scratching their heads, why would that be? But it also could be that this is going to be a substantial problem for us in the United States. In part, and there's absolutely no consensus. I read four articles on this morning, two in the Financial Times, one in the Wall Street Journal, and one online. I believe it was Forbes Online. And every single one offered a different opinion about why this is happening. But I think the best take on it has to do with the fact that the Chinese government last month said that they're going to put $3 billion into Blackstone Group. Remember yesterday we were talking about private, how public companies are going private, these private buyout companies, these Blackstone. The Chinese are buying into private equity firms. In other words, they're not buying treasuries. See, that's $3 billion of treasuries that they're not going to buy, which is about 3 weeks worth of our debt. And that, in the opinion of some people, is what's driving it up. And so here we have the story in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. bond yields hit a five-year high, with the yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note rising to nearly 5.25%. And then here comes the kicker. Driving up the cost of everything from $150,000 home mortgages to $20 billion leveraged buyouts, and threatening to slow the nation's economic growth. Investors continued to dump Treasuries yesterday, as they have for more than a week, amid worries about rising inflation abroad and concerns that foreigners might curb their purchases of U.S. bonds. And you know, this is something that, again, the consequences of Ronald Reagan running up the largest debt. Ronald Reagan ran up more debt during his presidency than every other president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan combined, including every war that we fought, combined. He borrowed all that money, and now George Bush has borrowed more money than Ronald Reagan. The only two presidents to have done this. Are they on the verge of wiping us out? I think so. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
And as we're talking about what's going on in Iraq and what might go on in Iran and what's going on in Afghanistan and all over the world, I think it's important to keep up with what's going on with our veterans. Larry Scott is with us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry, I really like this little tag that you've got up at the top of your website. I think this is new. VAWatchdog.org is not affiliated with, sponsored by, endorsed by, or approved by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Aren't you glad of that?
Aren't you?
I sure am. I think it's just great. Did you just put that up recently, or did I just notice it?
Yeah, no, I put that. Actually, that's way down at the footer on all of my pages. I put that as a disclaimer when I started the site. And I was looking at it the other day and said, you know, why don't I put that up at the top so people can actually see it? Because they should be glad that there's somebody out there trying to keep an eye on what the VA is doing.
Amen. And you're doing a fine job of
Thank
it.
You.
There's a number of veteran stories in the media here and that, you know, you're talking about over at VAWatchdog.org that I think are worthy of quick conversation between you and I here. The first one I mentioned yesterday, male veterans have a higher suicide risk, particularly combat vets.
Yeah, it's a new study which done, as a matter of fact, right in your area and my area at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. This study tracked 320,000 U.S. males. About a third of them were in the military, and they found out that men with military service commit suicide at more than twice the rate of men who did not have military service. This is a pretty astounding statistic. They're not quite sure why, because they didn't go that far in their study. They were just looking at numbers and not reasons. It is assumed, though, that this has to do with the stresses of combat, also the problems, some of the emotional problems that come out of combat, or just the fact that you get disabled, and there are so many disabled veterans. The other astounding figure there, Tom, was that veterans are 58% more likely to use a firearm when committing suicide. And that's just basically the understanding there. It's because that veterans are more likely to own weapons than the population in general. But the two times figure is astounding when it comes to the suicide rate.
You know, during the Vietnam War, there was a famous, well, I thought of it as famous, I saw it all over the country, poster that talked about, you know, the war. It was a quote, I don't remember the exact quote, and it was from you know, some old Catholic saint, as I recall, about something about wars always come home. You know, that a war always comes home to the country that declares it. And I just wonder if training people to blow up things and kill people, which I think we all acknowledge is an unfortunate but necessary function, if doing that in such a big way and in such an aggressive way is really a healthy thing for society. At what point should we be looking at this and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, maybe this, if nothing else, should be one of the things that causes us to say, why do we spend more on the military in the United States than all other countries in the world combined?
Those are questions we should really be asking, Tom, and of course we should put those into the human perspective, because every time you send someone into the military, and especially into a combat situation, you're putting that person's life not only on the line, but when they come back home, as you said, the war comes home. You're putting that person's life at risk.
You're changing their way of thinking. I mean, you're changing their life when you put them through basic training. You're teaching them to kill, and that's something that's quite unnatural, I think.
And the other problem there that we don't address that often is you're also changing the lives of all of the people around them, their significant other, their spouses, their children, their parents. All of those lives change too, as these stresses are become apparent over the years.
Yeah, I see a number of other stories here that I find interesting on your website. What are the ones that you think are the highest priority? We only have a couple of minutes here.
Well, one of the interesting things that we found here is that the McClatchy newspapers, formerly the Knight Ridder newspapers, have gone in again and found the VA cheating. And it's on their waiting list. You're supposed to, if you request an appointment, get an appointment with the VA within 30 days. If you're a veteran, VA says 95% success rate. McClatchy, digging into a new Inspector General report, a VA Inspector General report, says, that's about 75% or even less at many cases around the country. So what you have here is the VA juggling its own numbers, trying to make itself look good when it comes to serving veterans. And there's a great story that goes along with these waiting lists, Tom. If you go back to 2003, this became a political hot potato because there were somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 veterans waiting for health care. the Republican Party, and you can find this on the White House website, we will do away with waiting lists by the end of 2004, which was, of course, what? An election year.
Right.
They did that. They kept that promise. But guess how they did it? The problem wasn't waiting lists, per se. The problem was that VA did not have doctors available to treat these veterans who were on the waiting list. But what the Republican hierarchy who runs the VA did, they went out and hired enrollment clerks. They enrolled all of these 200,000 to 300,000 veterans, got them inside the system, and there the veterans sat waiting for health care because no more doctors were hired. But going into the 2004 election, whenever an administration official spoke to a veterans group, they stood up and said, we did away with the waiting list. There are no more veterans on waiting lists. Well, what had happened was those veterans had been shuffled from outside the system to inside the system. And once again, the VA shuffling numbers. They need more doctors for more treatment. They need it now.
Again, because Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary, a Republican political hack rather than a, well, in any case.
Exactly right.
Scott, yeah, VAwatchdog.org, great website, check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Brand new day is going to come about because of our efforts. You and me, we got to get out there and get active. One more reminder. Call John Conyers' office. Call Pat Leahy's office. Senator Pat Leahy, Congressman John Conyers, the respective chairman of the House and Senate, or Senate and House Judiciary Committees, and congratulate them for issuing subpoenas for these two women out of the Bush administration, Karl Rove's aide and George Bush's attorney, Harriet Myers and Sarah, what's her name, and call them and congratulate them. And perhaps most important, call your own member of Congress. Each one of us has one member of the House of Representatives and two senators. That's three calls. And you call 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. And if you're not sure who represents you, just give me your zip code. They'll tell you. And a toll-free number that may work is 866-220-0044. 866-220-0044. I think it's just so important that when the Democrats stand up and really do something well. I mean, these are the first subpoenas that have been issued in this whole case of the White House manipulating the judiciary to try to create 100 years of Republican rule. These are the first two subpoenas that have been issued, and we need to offer as much support as we possibly can to all of our representatives, including the Republicans. I mean, if you're represented by a Republican, call the Republicans' office and say, "Would you know?" Because there's Republicans on the House and Senate Judiciary Committee. Say, please support the Judiciary Committee's subpoenas of these two women out of the White House. As John Conyers said, all these breadcrumbs lead back to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We need to find out what's going on. Speaking of breadcrumbs and where they lead, there appears to be a growing trade or a growing kind of a bizarre form of tourism. There's been a lot in the press lately about sex tourism and stuff like that. Well, this is organ tourism. Need a new kidney? Need a new liver? Do you need a eye corneal transplant? Well, it might be possible to get it in a very strange way. And I don't mean that as like, gee, isn't this a great thing? David Mattis is with us. His website, organharvestinvestigation.net. Organharvestinvestigation.net. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, somebody needs a new kidney. They do what?
Well, one thing they can do, and they do in alarming numbers, is go to China and just pay money for it, because China has been offering transplants of all organs on short notice for quick turnaround for big payments.
Now, which begs the question, I mean, in all of the developed countries of the world, if you get on a transplant list, you may have to wait weeks, months, years. You wait until somebody, you know, is in a car crash or something or brain dead or whatever. They die in a way that makes their organs still viable, but they're not viable. How is it that China is able to, if I show up next week and say, hey, I need a new kidney, fine, we'll have it for you in 3 hours. How are they able to do that?
What they do is when you arrive, they kill somebody who's alive at the time for their organs. And there's the people they kill are people in prisons. And there's two sorts of prisoners they're killing. One of them is the prisoner sentenced to death, and the other is the Falun Gong practitioners, who are people involved in a type of spiritual exercise regime that the government has decided to repress and has arrested them in large numbers, made them non-persons, and they've become the primary source of these organs.
The Falun Gong people.
Yeah.
What evidence do you have of this, David?
Well, we did a report on it, and there's lots of different types of evidence. One of the things we've got is simply admissions. We have a confession from a surgeon, which he gave to his wife, and his wife told us about it. We have phone calls, which we've made to hospitals by people saying that they are customers or relatives and customers and asking the hospitals if they have organs from Falun Gong practitioners on the basis that the practitioners are healthy and therefore their organs would be healthy. And we've got the hospitals saying that this is so throughout China, and we've got tapes and transcripts and translations and telephone records to show that.
Wow. So if you call up and you say, I want a kidney, but I want it from somebody that I know has led a pure life. I don't want somebody who might be a drug addict and be infected with AIDS or Hep C or something like that. So these Falun Gong practitioners, they're sort of like Mormons. You know, they're known for their clean lifestyle. So can you get me a Falun Gong kidney? They say yes.
Yes, that's true. Not in every case, but we did quite a number of calls, and we had one caller call 80 different places, and 10 of them said yes. And another caller called 40 different places, and 5 of them said yes. So we have a number of these admissions.
What's been, first of all, is there any recognition of this in China as being something that is, you know, capitalism run amok in a negative way, or do they view it as, this is a nice way of using the power of the state and the power of the free market to help each other out?
It depends who you're talking to. I mean, some of the Chinese deny everything, you know. I mean, they deny Tiananmen Square. They're just kind of totally in denial about reality because they figure it suits their political propaganda purposes. The Deputy Minister of Health last November made a speech, which is public, and said that this is a problem, that it's illegal, but it's still happening, and that basically the law needs to be enforced so that we don't kill people without their consent for their organs. There have been changes in the law, both, two different times now, and the very fact that the law has changed is an admission that there's a problem, because if the law was fine, they wouldn't bother to change it. So they're kind of, they're half in admission, half in denial.
Amazing. And is there any effort being undertaken in the United States or any of the other developed nations, or, you know, I'm lacking a word. I want to say civilized, but it's really the wrong word to use, to protest this?
Some governments have raised this with the government of China, but, of course, all the government of China comes back with is baffle-gab, saying this is not happening, and we're making it all up, and it's all based on rumor and this sort of stuff.
David, when George Bush was hosting President Hu of China, there was a woman who stood up at the press conference and started shouting.
Yeah,
a Chinese woman, and she was grabbed and hustled away. And I read in a rather obscure news report. I mean, you know, is like, you know, paragraph 16 on page 22 of, I forget where it was, it might have been even the New York Times, that she was a physician from China protesting the harvesting of organs. Is my memory of that accurate? And if so, why was that not more widely? I don't think most Americans have any idea of that.
Well, there is, of course, a lot of publicity about this. I mean, I see it from the other end because I'm the co-author of the report that talked about this. So I tend to see anywhere in the world, wherever there's an article about it. And there is a fair amount going on all the time. I mean, I just heard something on the radio today about it. But, of course, I mean, the media is vast. And, I mean, it nowhere compares to the amount of reporting, let's say, in the war in Iraq and so on.
Well, has this ever made things like the ABC, CBS, NBC Evening News?
Well, I'm in Canada. I know I did an interview with ABC, but I think it was on, and no, it was radio and TV, but, you know, when it was shown and where it was shown, I'm not quite sure.
Or
but
if.
There obviously could be a lot more publicity than there is. I mean, part of the problem, of course, is how do you tell this story electronically when China is admitting nothing, not letting anybody into China to investigate, not showing anybody the prisons or the hospitals. So you don't have the visuals. And, of course, all the victims are dead and their bodies cremated. So it becomes a kind of difficult story to tell in the media time and time again, which is what you
Yeah, well, it seems like, you know, Dateline, what's his name, you know, the guy who's been running around busting the sexual predators, now they're going off to Nigeria to bust the scam artists. It seems like this would be a perfect thing for them to do, to set up a, you know, hey, I'm a customer, I'm coming over to China to get a new kidney.
Yes, absolutely. There are some people who've actually gone in undercover, but the trouble is it's a very fragmented process, so that what you see at the hospital is a body. And in order to follow it through, you'd actually have to get into the prison system. And nobody gets into the Chinese prison system. I mean, not the Red Cross, not any foreign government, not the UN. I mean, that part of the system is totally shut down in secret.
So the body the kidney's coming from, they could claim it was a car accident, and it in reality could be a Falun Gong member who was, you know, taken out in prison, and there would be no way of knowing because you don't have access to the prison system.
Well, that's right. Unless you can sort of go through the chain, you can't really check what they say. And they won't give you access to the records either, so you can't go through the records. And, of course, the people who are involved in this are criminals, and they're unlikely to confess.
David Mattis, the organharvestinginvestigation.net, the website. The consequences of absolute unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism combined with, shall we say, an undemocratic form of government. David, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Clean air, blue sky, will they be here when I die? Tall trees, white snow, will they be here when I go? I look up, I look down, pollution in the air, pollution on the ground. I look left, I look right, there's no relief in sight. Time has come to make a plan. Time has come to take a stand.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Hey, congratulations to JCB. JCB blogged over at airamerica.com. If you go to airamerica.com and click on the Tom Hartman pages, you'll find Louise Hartman's blog, which is our blog. And in the opinion of David Poole, our esteemed producer and generally all-around good guy, his pick for the day, by no particular criteria other than whimsy and the extraordinary power of his intellect, is from JCB's post. During a certain period of his life, Ronald Reagan believed in the Republican Party's principles. During that period, he had Alzheimer's disease. So that's JCB's quote, his blog posting over at airamerica.com, and JCB will receive an autographed copy, personalized and autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Congratulations, JCB. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So
it was very interesting. Yes?
What's that?
I was going to say it was very interesting in the White House press briefing room today because there were a couple of issues that came up. One, of course, was the subpoenas for the Harriet Myers and Sarah Taylor, former counsel to the president and former political director, and these, of course, in connection with the U.S. attorney's matter. That, of course, is something we would have expected. But a question was asked about the surge and about what was going to happen in September and the fact that, come on, by September, we're not going to know anything, are we? It's going to be impossible to know anything. And this whole question of September and the surge, which sounds like the beginning of a bad song, rather took over. And Tony Snow was put very much on the defensive about this. He did a fairly good job defending himself, but people kept saying, look, you keep saying that in September we're going to know this, 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 and this. And he said, no, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying you're going to know in September. We're not saying. And people started quoting things that have been told them about what we're going to know in September.
Hmm. And the way it wrapped up was basically an impasse, a draw?
It was a draw. It was an impasse. It was exactly what you would expect. It was an impasse. We were assured by Tony Snow that we would not, all we would know in September was how things are going. That we would not know that we had won.
So, in essence,
we would know how we're going.
So the essence of Tony Snow's comment was,
I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
Is that it?
That pretty much sums it up, actually.
Yeah, okay. All right. Now, I'm curious how this in Washington, D.C., how John Conyers, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and Pat Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, have issued the first subpoenas in this scandal involving the attempts by Karl Rove to turn the judiciary of the United States into the U.S. attorneys' alleged attempt. Yeah. Well, I'll call it an attempt. You're the reporter. You can be precise with your language. I honor and appreciate that. But nonetheless, these are the first subpoenas in this case. I've been encouraging people to call their member of Congress and ask their member of Congress to support Conyers and Leahy in this because the White House, I'm assuming, is already pushing back and claiming executive privilege.
They have not claimed that yet. In fact, Tony Snow did not claim that. They said that they're looking at them and that they will respond appropriately, to which everyone's basically going, oh, come on! Well, that's not exactly how they said it. I was giving more of the British parliamentary response than the American response.
Right. So, but what's the consensus? I mean, is there not one yet?
Executive privilege is the consensus of what the response is going to be.
Yeah. So then what happens?
That was my question, there were questions along those lines. Basically, it will not answer questions, will not answer hypothetical questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are considering it and they'll give an appropriate response.
Right.
He will not go any further. We even got into the whole question of people testifying under oath and transcripts again.
Amazing. Amazing.
That came up once again.
Do you know if Nixon had tried that? Well, actually, Nixon did try this, but ultimately, you know, it went before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that he had to turn over the tapes. And once he turned over the tapes, it was just a matter of 4 months from the time that the majority of the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee were stonewalling any attempts to even investigate him, to the point where they were actually saying that they would vote for impeachment of him. Do you see the possibility of that kind of Watergate moment where perhaps this will be a constitutional crisis and the Supreme Court will have to step in, and if they do, they may rule against the president? Or is your guess, or is the take of, you know, the conventional wisdom in Washington, that Bush is going to be able to last out the rest of his term and keep a lid on this?
I think the conventional wisdom is that he's going to be able to last out the rest of his term and keep a lid on this. I think also the other take would be that if the Supreme Court does step in, if some things move fast enough through the courts that it actually gets to the Supreme Court, that it's not necessarily going to go in the way that you're suggesting.
Right, because now we have the fascist five, as I call them, on the Supreme Court. oh, my. Okay. Well, interesting news. It's good to be informed, and frankly, what it tells me is it's even more important for us to contact our members of Congress. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you, as always. Tomorrow, Thursday, on the Tom Hartman Program, I'll be challenging H. Sterling Burnett about oil prices, gas prices. And Christy Harvey and Jim Motovalli are going to be here for our Best of the Rest of the News segment. Remember, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. Get active. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.